danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 242 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from a bitterly cold Owings Mills, Maryland. I am Andrew Brokus, and joining me from probably also a bitterly cold Melrose, Massachusetts, Nate Mavis.
Less cold than it has been. We still have not seen the other side of freezing since Christmas, and we're recording this on January 3rd, so it's been cold for a long time. But yeah, not quite as bad as it has been.
Yeah, we're supposed to get up to 30 today.
Nice. Nice. I assume you mean negative one.
I don't think in those terms. I find Fahrenheit more useful than Celsius. For most things, I'll admit that the metric system is superior, but I think that the additional gradations available within Fahrenheit are useful.
That's interesting. I mean, I can't do better than the XKCD comic about this, but I will say that usually I default to Fahrenheit just out of like my upbringing. But once things get around freezing or below, having freezing equals zero is very valuable to me. So
yeah, I agree with that. I think, you know, sometimes people make the argument of like, oh, it's so useful to know that like zero is freezing and 100 is boiling water. I'm like, how often do you need to know the temperature of boiling water? Why is that a number you need ready to hand?
Yeah. But it's freezing. Very important. But yes, cold in Melrose. Cold in Melrose. And, trying to raise my son. What's the analog of bilingual? Bimetrical?
So I haven't played poker really since maybe like the weekend before Christmas, like, you know, like 8 days before Christmas or whatever, just with all the like holiday stuff. I think maybe even longer, further back than that. It's just been like a kind of busy holiday season, and my experience, well, New Year's is kind of an exception. I was kind of under the weather on New Year's Eve, but like Thanksgiving, Christmas, my experience is those tend not to be great times at the casino. Just not as much action going on those weekends.
We have different experiences of Thanksgiving at the casino. How many Thanksgivings have you spent at the casino?
That's fair. I guess not. I was there this Thanksgiving weekend.
Thanksgiving week. Okay. Thanksgiving weekend is one thing. How many Thanksgivings?
Oh, have you spent on the casino? Literal day, none.
Thanksgiving 2005. I remember you fondly. I was at the Borgata.
Okay, well, let's control for the fact that it was 2005.
Well, okay, I also did it in, like, 2012. I'm just saying divorced guys and Asians. That's what I'm saying, okay?
I think part of the thing, too, around here, so many people aren't from Washington, D.C., so like if I were to go to National Harbor, where the bigger games tend to be, I think a lot of people, not just professional players, but just a lot of people in general are leaving D.C. that weekend. Not that there's nobody there. I mean, I guess there's still, if there's a game, I guess it has the potential to be good or whatever, but there's an outflux of people from D.C. back to like whatever places they're from to visit their families.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's probably also different if you're like hunting very big action as opposed to just trying to find a good 2-5 or 5-10 game.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
So we don't have a guest for this episode. I thought it would be nice to, every once in a while, I start to feel guilty about how overflowing the mailbag is. And sometimes I go through and pull out these emails from like a year ago and answer questions that people probably don't care about anymore. But hopefully we're choosing questions that that other people in the audience will be interested in. Oh, the other thing I meant to say, poker, in terms of my personal poker stuff, there's the Card Player Poker Tour, which is not something I had heard of before.
Wait, what?
There's a Card Player Poker Tour. Huh. And they're at Maryland Live like this weekend through next weekend. So I'm not sure if I'm going to do it. I always have this like perennial, I mentioned this on the show before, perennial debate of like, do I play a less good thing at Maryland Live or do I drive to National Harbor? That might depend on how I'm feeling. But I think next weekend I'll definitely play Maryland Live because there'll be a 1K main event for the Card Player Poker Tour there. So I've got that coming up.
Yep. It's a big enough tournament. It's worth your while.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, I miss these solo podcasts. It's been a very long time since I was a part of one of these.
Hi, this is Sean Lango, your friendly editor of the Thinking Poker Podcast. When I'm not attacking capped ranges or editing this show, I'm a musician, and you've been hearing my music from my old band Palmyra on this show for the past 200 episodes or so. Many listeners of this show have been very supportive to my collaborator Gina and I, and we want to ask for your support once again. We're currently 53% funded on our Kickstarter campaign for our brand new record, and we have only 8 days to reach our goal at the time this episode is released. We're very excited to bring you this new music and very grateful for any help that you can give. Thank you so much. Please visit www.softcenter.band for more information. Please do not visit softcenter.com because you will only find us at softcenter.band. Thank you.
Well, we'll be talking some strategy coming up, but if you really want some in-depth poker strategy, Tournament Poker Edge is the place to go for that. That's where you can hear me and some of Nate, actually, some of our former guests, many of our former guests, and many other folks as well make videos for Tournament Poker Edge. They've got a huge archive going back years, including hundreds of videos. You get access to all of it for as little as $25 a month. And you can sign up for that at tournamentpokeredge.com. This is not really a question, just a shout out from someone named Shoki, or hope I'm pronouncing that somewhat correctly. He said, "Hey, I'm literally listening to episode 221 at the moment." I've forgotten the significance of what episode 221 might have been. I'm literally listening to episode 221 at the moment and wanted to shout out to say you have listeners in Japan, too. Keep up the great work. I really love the show, and thanks for picking up my question on one of your episodes earlier. Thanks for listening. It's always interesting for us to hear what different places people are listening to us from. And I'm glad you enjoyed episode 221, whatever that may have been. And I'm glad that you enjoyed us talking about your question. Thank you for writing in with a question. Thank you for writing in with a shout out. And I guess even before we get into other questions, we can encourage other folks who would like to hear their questions answered on the show eventually. Doesn't always happen quickly. Can write to podcast@thinkingpoker.net with your questions. Likewise, if you want to just give us a shout out from someplace that we might not be thinking that we have listeners, that's always cool for us to hear.
I think that's what we were doing on episode 221, which is
right,
why you mentioned it.
So, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a joke at our expense, or my expense anyway, about being slow to answer these questions.
Yes. Did you say Shoki?
S-H-O-K-I.
Hello. Hi, Shoki. Hello to Japan. This is exciting. So thanks for listening.
Our next one is coming from Ethan. Ethan says, this is from an anonymous 6-max game online. No noteworthy reads on the opponent. Did seem a little looser than average in a small sample size. 100 big blind effective stacks. Hero has king 10 of spades. Under the gun folds. Hero in middle position raises to 3 big blinds. Villain calls in the cutoff. And other players fold. I think nothing too controversial to discuss so far. So we go to the flop, our hero holding king 10 of spades. The flop is queen of hearts, 6 of spades, 4 of spades. 7.5 big blinds in the pot. Hero bets 5 big blinds. Villain calls. I like it. I guess the one thing I would throw out there as an alternative is, you know, this is a spot where you can do some check raising as well. And I don't think there's anything wrong with betting. I just like to put this out there because I think a lot of people don't really ever consider check raising the flop when they're the pre-flop raiser, or maybe they only do it when they flop a set or something like that. But I think this is a situation, especially if you're dealing, I mean, not so much if you're dealing with a looser player. Like, the looser your opponent is, the more value there is in just kind of blindly continuation betting. Not that this is a bad hand to continuation bet, but I think against a better player, like, I don't think you can expect that you're just going to be able to see bet any two cards in this spot and show a profit. So I think that this is a spot where you should be doing some check folding, which means that your opponent has a decent amount of incentive to bet when checked to, and therefore you get to, or you know, have incentive to have a check raising range as well. So I would give, and I think this is a pretty nice candidate for it because it's a hand that, like, wants the additional fold equity, doesn't mind playing a bigger pot if the villain ends up calling you, doesn't mind getting a free card if it goes check check. I think there's a lot to recommend this hand for check raising, and I wouldn't be surprised if we were looking at a solver if it were playing a mix of bets and check raises with this hand.
Yep. And to say something that's behind what you're saying, and just a little more fundamental, maybe, is that when one person is out of position with a raiser range and one person is in position with a calling range and it comes queen, little, if the stacks are really, really short, probably the raiser has the advantage. If the stacks are really, really deep, probably the caller has the advantage in position. And if we're at normal depth, you know, it's I think, not a situation that favors either one too much. So you're probably going to want to check at least sometimes. So you're going to have a checking range, and then you got to figure out what goes in the checking range. And this is a pretty good candidate for it. Again, I wouldn't be surprised if you check some and bet some. I certainly think you definitely should be checking some flush draws and betting some flush draws. Like, that's pretty certain. I just don't know what to do with this flush draw.
Right.
So one thing about check raising, and sorry to go all 2012 on you here, is that if you raise, like, you can hit a king, you can hit a 10, ace, jack, nine give you gut shots, so you're going to be able to pick up equity on a lot of cards, so maybe that makes it more attractive to barrel, maybe not. You know, again, that's I think one thing that poker players have gotten away a little bit from is, like, oh, I picked up any equity, like, something good happened or something good could happen, I should pot it. Like, yeah, I think but I do think that you're gonna realize at least some of your equity on a lot of turn cards, or you're gonna the turn's gonna improve you. You're still gonna have some equity left on the turn a lot of the time.
Yeah, and I think that's something that makes this maybe a slightly more appealing check raise than, like, 10-8 of spades, where, I mean, I guess there's a lot of ways that you can, like, turn, or there's at least a few ways you can turn a gutter with 10-8 of spades, but you never have an overcard to the queen, which is, you know, a big part of your opponent's calling range, which, when you check raise the flop. So I think, like, that diminished equity against the queen makes a big difference in terms of your check raising range. Not to mention, like, you know, 10-8 of spades is a slightly less good hand when a spade peels off. Not that, like, flush under flush is a huge concern when 100 big blinds deep, but just in terms of, like, what kinds of hands do you want to build really large pots versus, like, medium-sized pots with, and then, you know, the more like an 8-7 of spades or something where you have a gutter and a flush draw, or if you have some sort of, like, combo draw, those again become more appealing check raising hands. But I think, like, what we would actually find looking at a solver is probably a mix of all of these.
Yep, I agree.
So our hero bets 5 big blinds, the villain calls, and the turn brings the 10 of diamonds. So our hero is holding king 10 of spades, and the board is now queen of hearts, 6 of spades, 4 of spades, 10 of diamonds. It's 17.5 big blinds in the pot, and I believe 92 big blinds in the effective stacks. What do you like doing here now that we've turned middle pair?
I think it's a legitimately tricky spot. We should have some equity if we barrel. I don't think we're going to get raised too often if we bet. The opponent might think that we turned a gutter and might decide to try to shut us out with a hand like ace king or queen king queen, but I think that's unlikely. And the way the stacks are, we can choose a bet size that discourages a raise, especially if we're not playing this hand against a wizard who's gonna sort of think to the next level and read our bet size as discouraging a raise. So as long as we don't bet full pot, I think we should make it awkward for our opponent to raise. I do think we're going to get called sometimes on the turn, but there should be a lot of three barreling opportunities on the river, especially if we're representing a mix of made hands and draws on the turn. We're also going to make our hand sometimes. So I think I would bet about 10 big blinds here, looking to bet a lot of rivers, whether or not I get there. Does that make any sense?
This would be with the intention of trying to make the villain fold a queen?
Queen or... yes. Yes. Some queens. Yes. And certainly, but like, I also think that there are a lot of combinations of pocket pairs in his range, some of which, like many of which, will not give up the flop.
Yeah, although you're beating those now, though.
Oh, that's right.
That's kind of my concern with continuing to bet, is like, it's one of those, you know, yeah, we've improved the hand, but it's almost like we've improved to a medium strength hand at this point. So it's like, you know, on the flop we had a hand that had a lot of equity but not a lot of showdown value, which makes it a, you know, a pretty good bluffing candidate. Whether we do that bluffing by betting or check raising, you know, it's a good bluffing candidate. And then the turn, you know, arguably we've improved to the point where like we haven't improved to the point where we have a value betting hand, I think, or, you know, where we can expect to be ahead of a calling range. But at the same time, I think we maybe improved enough that it's no longer a great bluffing candidate. Like, it's because we're going to have trouble making the opponent fold a hand that has significant equity against us. You know, maybe you put enough pressure on a queen by like betting turn, shoving river, but I think that's a little tenuous.
And like, we beat a queen a lot of the time anyway, just by doing other things. Okay, I think my plan was bad. I blame fatherhood. Okay, yeah. So let's check. How about that?
Yeah, I think that's kind of where you have to start here. And it is worth keeping in mind, you know, that you're going to be checking a lot of hands in this situation. I mean, most people, we had our discussion before about how you probably shouldn't be, you know, c-betting this flop at as high of a frequency as many people do. But regardless, like, you know, especially if you are c-betting often on this board, but even if you aren't, I mean, you're going to have a fair number of hands where you like, you bet the flop and now you're checking the turn to give up. And so, you know, your opponent will have some incentive to bluff. Your opponent will have some incentive, maybe even to bet a hand worse than this one. Certainly will have some incentive to, I mean, just like, this is one of the stronger hands. Like, it's a nice hand to have in your checking range. Like, you're going to have a lot of weak hands that you're checking here, and this is like, it's not a strong hand, but it's, you know, it's a hand that can happily call a turn bet. So if your opponent did float you with something like 8-7 suited, you know, a flush draw would be another plausible candidate that you know the opponent called the flop with and would be looking to bluff the turn. We block some of those. I mean, the king of spades is a pretty significant blocker to flush draws, but there are still some flush draws that he could plausibly have, like a jack nine of spades or ace x of spades is still available to him. So I mean, there are some flush draws he could have that we can induce bluffs from those as well by checking and calling. So I think at this point we kind of want to treat it as like a very good bluff catcher rather than either a value hand or a bluffing hand. And I think the mistake, and I realize, Nate, fatherhood is the explanation in your case, but I think a lot of people just sort of don't feel comfortable giving up the betting lead. And so they're like, well, I improved my hand, I have to keep betting. Or, you know, it might be a difficult decision if I check, so I have to keep betting.
Yeah.
Good. Now, to his credit, this is not what Ethan does. Ethan does, in fact, check the turn. The villain bets 13 big blinds, and the hero calls, which I think is pretty straightforwardly correct. I mean, maybe I can see a case for check raising the turn, but I think, again, we get into this issue of, like, what really is that designed to accomplish? You can't, I don't think, I mean, there's really not a lot of hands that have significant equity against you. Like, when King 10 of spades is ahead, it's way ahead because the spades block so many of your opponent's outs. And when it's not ahead, it's a little difficult to imagine, you know, getting the villain off of better hands.
Yep. The only thing I will add, and this I think is actually like an okay play, it's like in live games sometimes when you're up against a certain kind of live player who is extremely passive and too loose, like who will check back this turn almost all the time if you check, and has called preflop with too many hands, betting like a quarter of the pot is nice just for value. Like, just, yeah, you know, like get a call out of ace high or pocket fives or whatever it is. Star five on the board, small pocket pair, that's not a pair.
Yeah, six and four on the board. But yeah, I know
what you mean. You don't get raised basically ever. I mean, against this person. I know it sounds like I'm just positing an opponent against whom betting small is good, and then saying you should bet small against that opponent. But the thing is that person actually exists. Oh, yeah. So you should remember that play.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point.
Yep, good.
The river is the queen of spades. So our final board now is queen of hearts, six of spades, four of spades, 10 of diamonds, queen of spades. So our villain, or our hero, river is a flush, but there is a pair on the board. 43.5 big blinds in the pot and 80-ish remaining in the effective stacks. What do you
Sorry, like? we checked and called the turn.
We checked and called the turn. Yeah, villain bet 13 big blinds and hero called.
I like a check. I think hands that call are very likely to bet, and some hands that will not call will also bet. And then if he bets, you can probably raise and get called. And sometimes you lose, but more of the time you win.
Yeah, I think this is a check raise all in situation. We've got about two bets remaining in the effective stacks. We have a flush. It's not the nuts, but it's pretty damn close. And I think we want to put as much money into this pot as we can. And I think you're right. You know, if the villain has a queen, it's hard to imagine him checking back the river here. I think it's going to look very strong if you just come out betting right now. Like what would your bluff be in that situation where you bet the flop, check call the turn, and then bet this river? You know, it's awfully hard to imagine looking weak doing that. I think you're not going to get raised by worse for sure. So, you know, you definitely don't get two bets into the pot by betting the river. And I think there's some risk you don't even get one into the pot. So I think, you know, checking, you allow the villain to bet again with his bluffs. This is going to be a very appealing card for him to bluff if he did bluff the turn. You know, it's going to be very appealing for him to follow through on this river card. And if he is not bluffing, you know, I think a lot of the hands that would consider calling a river bet, as you said, you know, are going to bet. And then you just have to check raise and hope he doesn't have a full house.
Yeah, and you can also, again, sorry, live eMic, live pro coming in here. Like, you can also look at the bet size. Like, if you check and he pots it, do you still want to raise?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I think I would just call at that point.
Yeah. It's hard for him to have a full house. Basically, it takes a small pair that hit a set on the flop. We block a 10. Hard for him to have queen 10. But, yeah, I would probably check raise. But, you know, thinking costs you nothing. Think about the whole hand. Think about the bet size. And go from there.
Okay, well, here's what ends up happening. The hero checks. The villain bets 27 big blinds into a pot of 43.5. And we don't have any results beyond that. Ethan wanted to avoid biasing us with the results, but that strikes me as exactly the kind of bet size I was looking to check raise.
Yep, I think he's got a queen a lot. I think you should move all in and expect to lose sometimes, but not enough to make moving all in bad.
Nice. So I have a guess, just kind of based on the way this email was written, that he may have gotten called by a full house. But yeah. So sorry, Ethan, if that happened. But we think you played the hand well if you did check raise the river. So well done.
Yeah. Also, this is a live game. You get to see people just give you the most condescending possible looks. Like, maybe he didn't notice that the board was paired. Like, maybe he doesn't know that a full house beats a flush.
Or they give you that shrug after they win the pot where they're like, what am I going to do? I had a full house. Of course I called you. Like, I wasn't bluffing.
Yeah. I don't know why. I was just remembered of the time when, like, somebody claimed in perfect sincerity to have been bluffing with the second nuts. All these things, like, people really feel bad about putting money in without the nuts. So so thanks for writing, Ethan. We'd be curious to know results.
Oh wait, we have to read Ethan's sign off. Big fan of the podcast. You guys are awesome. Thanks, Ethan. So thank you for writing, Ethan.
Appreciate that.
Here's two questions coming to us from Sam, both of which are directed at you. A voracious podcast listener for about 2 years now. Thanks for all the great content. I have two questions more aimed at Nate. For career reasons, I'm leaving Chicago and returning to my hometown of Minneapolis, Minnesota. Minnesota.
Nice city. I mean, Chicago's a great city too, but Minneapolis, I was just there. It's nice.
Minnesota, along with Puritan alcohol laws, doesn't allow no limit cash, only tournaments. Limit cash game action, according to Bravo, looks to be still alive and well. I'm excited about this. I imagine that the absence of no limit cash generally leads to fewer pros living in Minneapolis, and I'm guessing the 10-20 limit game is probably beatable with a little hard work. Looks like the casinos occasionally spread Omaha and stud as well. First question. I'm a complete beginner when it comes to limit games. Nate, what resources do you recommend?
Boy, I wonder if the 2+2 forums are still okay on Limit. There was a good live Limit forum on 2+2 before. A lot of the books are directed at like very advanced players. I'm not sure the books are your best way to learn Limit if your goal is to beat a 10-20 live game. You know, Ed Miller's got a Limit book, though. Hard to go wrong with that. I would probably look on... It's a good question. Honestly, I'd start with the video. Start with the training video. Just sort of gorge yourself on Limit Hold'em. That will also have the problem of being directed to a much tougher game, but you can look for like really low stakes online videos, and you'll just get a lot of good information. I would also look at 2+2, the mid stakes Limit forum. That was effectively a live poker forum last I checked, and there's a lot of good stuff there about how to play in the live setting. I do think the game should probably be okay. I know there are a lot of like stone cold Limit crushers who live in Minnesota. Like that's where like Schneids and Bicycle Kick and all those people.
Schneids
like,
was my first thought when he said that.
Yeah. But they're not playing 10-20.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't surprise me if there are just people who have been playing Limit Hold'em forever. Isn't Danielle Anderson from around there?
But she lives in Las Vegas now.
Well, she does, but like I'm saying, like there are like people who are good poker players and who have just been playing Limit for freaking ever. But like that's also true of Arizona, and those games are fine. So, enjoy your 10-20 Limit game. It'll be fun. It moves fast. Enjoy. It's great.
When you talk about the differences between like live and online poker, you're saying like, you know, these resources are less good because, you know, live games. Like, what do you see as those differences?
Worse oppositions, a lot more multi-way pots, and a lot more live information. Like, one thing about these casual Limit games is, like, they're just Tell City. Like, they're just tons. Because, like, people aren't, like, it's just the culture of it. It's just different. Like, people aren't really trying to conceal information in the same way. And, it's just, there's just so much physical information. And, like, also... I don't know. Like when I was playing in Arizona, there was this chain must move thing. I think it's still like that. So like every hand you played would be with a different number of players because of like the weird rules that they use. And I don't know, with everybody walking, you have people posting behind. There's all this dead money in the pot half the time. It's just like you're going to worry so much about blind defenses if you're playing like six max online at reasonable stakes. Like that's just so much of what you're doing. And you're also going to be worried a lot about 3- and 4-bet pots. And then in live games, you're just going to be playing all these single-raised three-handed pots. probably that's different now from what it was 10 years ago when I played a lot of live Limit Hold'em. But I drop in on these games every so often. And it's still, like, it's just not this online environment where everything's 4-bet. And, like, the way to win is to get your frequencies for check-raising and the flop and the blind defense exactly right. It's just not what you're doing. You're just doing other things.
Yeah, that's very much been my experience with a little bit. You know, I've had a few forays into kind of, like, mid-stakes Limit Hold'em game, live games. And it's amazing how much people who have been playing this game for a long time. Like, you know, the people that are organizing these games, there's kind of, like, there's, like, a regular game that happens at Maryland Live. And the people who organized this game have been playing Limit Hold'em together for a really long time, you know, like since before the poker boom, you know?
Yeah.
And they still are like, I mean, frankly, don't really know what they're doing.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It's kind of amazing, like how much people, like the aggression. So I've just, I don't want to like tell a bad beat story exactly, but that one of like very early hands that I played, there's like, let's see, what was the action? I think a woman in like the hijack or the cutoff opens for a raise. The small blind calls. I have ace jack suited in the big blind, which struck me as like a pretty clear 3-bet. So I 3-bet, she 4-bets, small blind folds, I call. The flop is like ace 3-3. I check, she bets, I call. Turn is a blank, a 5 or something. I check, she bets, I call. River's a 3. In retrospect, I think check calling here might be the better play, but I bet she raised. Again, I think folding here could actually be the best play. I call, she has pocket aces, and the one of the organizers of the game, who's been, you know, playing with her for a long time, he's like, I knew that was aces. As soon as she four bet, I knew that was aces. I was like, yeah. What? How is that possible? In a limit hold'em game with a person who's been playing for 25 years, and she only four bets aces? Like, how is that possibly a thing?
Yeah, it's a thing. Yeah, welcome to limit hold'em. How it is. I would also check that river.
Yeah, no, I mean, I felt pretty stupid after the fact, but I mean, I think like even folding the flop could be the correct play, or folding the turn
No. I mean, against Sumpers, like, I can think of somebody against whom I would fold the flop, but don't do that after 25 minutes or however long you were playing.
Yeah, it wasn't even that long. I mean,
yeah, don't do that. Okay. Don't do that. Anyway. Like, don't do it just because, like, your opponent's 70 years old, for example. Don't do that.
Okay, yeah, that was kind of how I was leaning. Our second, this is the second question from Sam. Sam also says, for my new job, I'll need to learn Python and SQL. Again, complete beginner. I use VBA pretty frequently in my current job, and I'm not worried about diving into technical/difficult material. Nate, I know you've self-taught yourself a lot of this stuff. Any favorite books on the topic? What would you point me to?
Yeah, good question. Depends exactly what you'll be using it for. My favorite, like the thing I did at the very beginning that was best for me, was an online course. It's free. It's from MIT's OpenCourseWare. It's called Introduction to Computer Science and Programming, and it's Python based, and it's just great. It's just really, really great. It reminds me of what Sklansky said about his, like, for advanced players books. Like, it's for inexperienced people who are capable of learning. So, like, it's not dumbed down. It just starts from the beginning, and it's very project based. It's very practical. It's just tremendous, and I recommend it very highly. There will be a link in the show notes. As for SQL, as with all things with computers, I would start with a project. Like, if you start learning SQL from first principles, like, I mean, I've got a math background. I love learning things from first principles, but probably it sounds like you don't want to be learning about database architecture and normal forms and things like that. I would start by just finding something with... finding something that you can query with SQL that you care about. For me, that would be baseball statistics. Like, that's how I started. And then just, like, start asking yourself questions. Like, last year, how many players who are at least 30 years old hit 30 home runs? And then it's like, oh, how do I do that? And then, like, Google around until you can find the answer. One thing is that, like, Google is really good, and every question has been asked and answered on the internet, or at least every question beginners would ask. So, like, really just do something and try to make like a little project for yourself, and then you'll figure it out. There's the thing about SQL, there's, like, a lot of syntax, and just for me, you'll do a lot better if you're driven by like a project or an interest in it, rather than just trying to gorge yourself on syntax and remember it all. And in general, I think learning computer stuff, yeah, that's a good way to do it, unless you have aspirations to, like, make the best compiler in the world for something, and you really, really need to start with the formalism and the fundamentals, like, really from zero. I would just start with a project. It's like, oh, I want to automate my grocery list. That's something I did at the beginning. I want to learn about baseball. I want to do this. You know, just start. Project Euler is also, if you're a mathy person, it's a nice thing to do. It's math problems that you need a computer to help solve for the most part. So just do a project. When you get stuck, Google around until you can find an answer, and repeat until you run a consultancy in data. Like, super fun, by the way. Man, running a business, just starting. It's great. I love it.
This is another one of those things that I have a very tiny amount of experience with, more as the beginner person. But that was kind of an eye-opening thing for me, what you said about, like, not having to learn all the syntax. It was always kind of intimidating to me just to see code written out, and you're like, holy crap, there's some. It's like it's literally a different language. But then you kind of get the sense as you start working on it that you're like, very few people, like, have this language memorized. Most people are just Googling stuff, it seems. When there's things that they need to do, they just are sort of looking up how to do it. It's not like they just have all of this. I mean, the particular things that they do most often, I'm sure they have ready to hand or whatever, but sure. Yeah, it seemed like there's so many good resources on there for, it seems like the more important skill maybe is knowing where to go to find answers rather than cramming all the answers into your head.
And certainly at the beginning. And I want to warn our correspondent here that when you get to a certain point, you will be restrained by what you don't know. If that's the only way in which you learn things, like if you've learned everything by just hacking together knowledge and Googling, then there'll be all these things that you don't even know are possible. You won't have a great sense of what the strengths of different languages are. Like, you'll know how to do something in Python, but you won't know why you should be doing it in Python instead of C, Ruby, something else. And eventually you'll get to a point where you need to study things more systematically and you know, learn more about the why, learn more about what's going on under the hood, learn more about what languages are best suited for different things. But I think that can safely come later. It came later for me. And as long as you know that level of a deeper knowledge is out there, then I think you're fine. It's a little bit like learning heuristics for betting and checking in poker, then later saying, then not learning the game theory stuff until later. Like, it's just fine to learn the what first and then learn the why later.
Well said. Thank you for writing, Sam. This is probably coming too late to be of use to Sam. I think he wrote us in like March, but hopefully other people will find that useful. Every time that we or you really have talked about this kind of stuff on the show, I think there's been a decent amount of listener interest and people asking questions like this one. So it seems like there's no shortage of listeners to this show who also have some interest in computing and programming.
It's just nuts to me. Like, I think back 5 years ago or 6 years ago or however long, and like, I did a little bit of coding in high school and along the way, but like, for the most part, it was 2011-ish when I sat down and I thought, like, oh, I'm a grad student. I am writing my dissertation. I would like to have some hobbies so I don't go crazy writing my dissertation, which I'm working very hard on. Like, what are hobbies that I can do without really any money? Like, huh? Well, coding is a good one. There are all sorts of free resources out there, and most of them don't require a powerful computer. Like, huh, podcasting. This guy Andrew might start a podcast with me. I wonder if I did. And both of those have turned out pretty well for me.
Our next question coming from Brendan. Brendan says, I'm on break from grad school, back at home, playing in a casino near me in Pennsylvania. I usually play 1-2, but have decided to take a small shot at 2-5 for a session. I'm a 23-year-old student with glasses who is somewhat of a stereotype of someone who takes the game seriously. I think this is an important part of my image, even if no one has mentioned something like that this game. I've been somewhat active at the table and have been stacked once in an all-in flip situation, but haven't gotten to showdown besides that. Main villain is a 45-year-old white male sporting Under Armour clothes who has stated that he's a, quote, suburbs kind of guy and has spent a lot of time discussing Range Rovers. He's clearly a regular from the area and knows the dealers well. I have pocket jacks under the gun plus one. Folds to me, I raise to $15. This has been the standard opening size for the game. Folds to main villain and cutoff, who calls, small blind folds, big blind calls. Big blind is a straightforward 50-ish-year-old player who will not be too relevant for the hand. I have $700 and I'm covered by both villains. Was there something you wanted to say, Nate?
No, I'll get there.
Okay.
I'll get there.
So our hero holding pocket jacks, called by the cutoff and the big blind, and the flop is 9 of clubs, 7 of diamonds, 4 of spades. With $50 in the pot, small blind checks. Hero bets $35, cutoff thinks not too long before calling, and small blind calls $35. Anything controversial about betting here?
Against these guys, no, probably. In theory, I think probably you should be checking this hand at least sometimes, but there are a lot of good reasons to bet. I would default to betting against good players and bad players in this live setting. I would probably bet. I also think that the small blind overcalling a $35 bet on this flop makes him relevant to the hand.
What do you see as the case for checking this?
You have a hand that doesn't want to play a big pot, and checking controls the pot size, and it puts an overpair in your checking range. The natural thing to do is put some federal repairs in your attacking range. Mm-hmm. But, you know, jacks, it's, there are times when, especially against like a raise happy, like, opponent, you're going to be faced with a raise too often with a hand that really doesn't want it. A lot of opponents that will raise a lot will also bet a lot, and you have a hand that plays great checking and calling and does not play great when you bet and get raised, and especially if this guy is like cranky that they're not going to pay for the wall, maybe he's gonna bet too much and raise too much, and you just want to check it to him.
Yeah, I think that's fair. My main thought was what you said about stronger overpairs would probably be better candidates for that. You know, the thing about jacks here is it is a hand that benefits a lot from both folds and calls, right? And those tend to be the very best hands for betting. I mean, if you kind of think about the expected value of a bet, right, the expected value equation, it basically breaks down as like there's the value you get from the hand your opponent folds, and then there's the value you get from the hand your opponent does not fold. And you know, the does not fold category includes both calls and raises. And as you said, you know, the more likely you are to get raised, like that's the part that's really bad for jacks. The calls and the folds are both nice for jacks, and then the raises is where it gets unpleasant. So you know, it does, like that is certainly a relevant term in the equation. But if you think you're not going to get raised too often, which I think many live games you don't, then it kind of comes down to you benefit, like many hands worse than jacks will call a bet here, and also many hands that have equity against jacks, you know, including even just like one live overcard or whatever, you know, are folding two bets, and both of those things are pretty good for you. You know, I think often when people think about protection, they tend to think in terms of like overly strong, you know, people think about, oh, there's, you know, what if someone has 10-8, I need to protect against 10-8. Well, no one's folding 10-8. I mean, you're not really protecting against like an open-ended straight draw or hands that have like that more, you know, flush draws. People always say, well, there's a flush draw on the board, I have to protect my hand. You can't really protect from a flush draw. I mean, you can bet and get value from a flush draw in the sense that, you know, people will call and maybe be behind your hand. But when we talk about betting for protection, it's not usually protecting from hands that have that much equity. Hands with like 8 or 9, you know, obvious outs, outs that are like to nut or near nut hands. Those hands aren't really folding to bets. The kinds of hands that are folding to bets might be, you know, gut shots or overcards where people maybe don't even realize the overcard is going to be an out for them, or, you know, something along those lines, like bottom pair, maybe like 5-4 folds. I mean, there are hands like that that have 25 to 30% equity that you can cause to fold with a flop bet. And there's a decent amount of value in that when you combine that with the fact that you're also going to be in pretty good shape when your bet is called. So if you compare jacks to a hand like pocket aces, where, I mean, some of those hands like 5-4 still have equity against pocket aces, but like obviously overcards are much less of a big deal for pocket aces. That's the kind of overpair that I would be more inclined to check here, although I do see your point, Nate.
Yeah.
Brendan says, I feel pretty confident that jacks are often the best hand on this board. From villain's perspective, I think the board is dry enough that I could be c-betting with a large portion of my range, expecting to get it through often enough. Hands like queen-jack suited, ace-king off, king-queen off, etc. On the other hand, my value range should be essentially just overpairs, since I would most likely check sets on this board texture. I want to talk about that for a second. I think I think that it's you know, it's not unreasonable, but it does require a set of assumptions about your opponent. I mean, I think essentially what you're assuming is that your opponents are going to fold way too often on this flop, and so you're saying I can just kind of bet with abandon when I have any hand that doesn't seem very good to me on this board. I can just sort of bet all of those and have that be profitable. But because they're going to be folding so often, I don't really want to bet my sets. This doesn't strike me as that sort of board texture, and you know, I'm not playing with these people. You know them presumably better than I do, but this strikes me as a board texture that actually doesn't really favor you that much as the preflop raiser. Not that you couldn't have, you know, some of the hands that coordinate well with this board, but I think these medium cards, you know, the players who called preflop have a lot of, you know, 6-5 suited, 7x suited, 9x suited, 10-8 suited. All the sets, you know, all that kind of, like, their range is pretty thick with that kind of stuff. And it strikes me particularly as the cutoff, like, this is not a board I see myself folding very often to a preflop raiser. I mean, I'm kind of looking for half an excuse to flow to or raise you, which is kind of to Nate's point about not necessarily wanting to bet over pairs for fear of getting into bad spots later. I think this is a very dynamic board that benefits the player in position a lot, and a board where over pairs are not super strong hands, and are, in particular, are not going to be super strong hands by the time we get to the river. So it does not strike me as the greatest situation to think, I can just see bet any two cards and show a profit. And I actually would be pretty inclined to bet sets here, because I think that there are so many. I mean, A, they benefit a little bit from protection actually on a board like this, but also I think there's so many second best hands are going to be looking to fight you on a board, or should be looking to fight you on a board like this.
Yeah, all day, every day, especially with the opponent as described, and especially this guy asked us about his image, and like, I like when I'm at a table where people say I look like Harry Potter, like. like when the opponent is like with the Under Armour and the Range Rover and this board texture, like, let's think about, like, this person, he's probably calling you a lot pre-flop. He's probably even calling with, like, the small over pairs. Got all these pairs, all these gutters. Like, he's not going to fold those hands. He's not going to fold those hands. All those draws, he's going to put you on a draw. He's going to have a draw sometimes. No. Bet all day. I'll be unbalanced. Bet all day with your sets. And, like, honestly, like, and that goes even... Like, one reason I might check jacks here is that, like, aces is too good to check in this spot, I think, against this person sometimes, just because, like, you're going to get six bet by tens in a flush draw or whatever, or, like, tens without a flush draw, like, tens or separately a flush draw. Like, no. Bet your sets all day, every day. Not too big. Let them think you're continuation betting. Mm-hmm. Let them play back at you.
Yeah, I think even top set, you know, there are cases sometimes where, you know, top set makes a very appealing slow playing hand, but this is not really a board where blocking top pair is that relevant.
Doesn't matter. Bet all day.
There's so much other stuff that's giving you action here besides 9x that I think, you know, pocket nines is still a hand that benefits a lot from betting. And it's like, you know, there's a lot of turn cards where 9x is suddenly, or where a set of nines is like not going to be that close to the nuts anymore on a lot of turns. And certainly by the time we get to a lot of rivers. So, you know, you do want to build that pot early and get some fold equity as well early when you have even very strong hands like pocket nines.
Yeah, and like, if you bet and get raised, what can you do? You can 3-bet. Put you on a flush draw.
There's no flush draw on the board. It's a rainbow flop.
Oh, sorry.
But yes, I mean, the fact that this is a time you should expect to get raised sometimes on this board, and you have a hand that obviously is very happy to get raised when you have a set, is all the more reason to bet. I agree with that. Brendan continues, two calls is somewhat concerning, but I can be somewhat confident that Big Blind shouldn't have too many super strong hands at this moment, since he would raise hands like 4s and 9-7 suited a decent frequency on the flop. That being said, the flop is quite dry, and he might be waiting to lead turns or check raise turns with those hands. In any case, I think being in position will help us get away should he show any strength later in the hand. Cutoff's range is somewhat more important and undefined. I think you could have a lot of suited nines, as well as some pocket pairs and draws. Although we heavily block Jack-X combos, I think cutoff is likely to slow play a sets and two pair on this board texture. Additionally, I think he is also capable of floating with overcards to apply pressure on later streets, depending on the board. There's a lot going on there, and I think, you know, some of it we've addressed already. I do think it's a little contradictory to say, you know, he's capable of floating with overcards, or there's all the stuff he's going to call me with, but also, you know, I wouldn't bet my sets, and I would bet king-queen off soon. I think, you know, if this is your read on the... And I think what you're saying now about the cutoff makes more sense. You know, we disagreed with the bit earlier about wanting to just sort of randomly bet bet over cards and check sets. I think what you're saying now about the cutoff is I and probably Nate is more inclined to agree with, that you should kind of expect that he's going to put up a fight here, but I think that does contradict a little what you were saying earlier about the continuation betting. In terms of whether people are going to be like slow playing sets or two pair, I mean, I think we may just be fundamentally looking at this board texture differently. This does not strike me as a great board, and we've kind of discussed this already, as like a very obvious slow playing board. I know live players do love their slow playing and like to find excuses for it, so I'm not going to say you're wrong if your belief is that your opponents will often, you know, slow play very strong hands in this situation, but I guess I would fundamentally disagree with calling this like a dry flop. I think it is a board where sets are going to become quite a bit less strong by the time we get to the river. And certainly the kinds of hands that sets are value targeting, like over pairs, are, you know, not going to be excited about playing big pots on later streets. And so sets really should be, I think, trying to get their money in on earlier streets. The turn is the eight of hearts. So now we have $155 in the pot, our hero holding pocket jacks. The board is 9-7-4-8. No flush draws are possible. Big blind checks. What do you like to do with jacks here? Are you betting again?
Tough spot. Three-handed pot. Better hands in a live setting are pretty unlikely to fold, especially to you. I think since you're unlikely to get semi-bluffed really well, I think you can get away with a check here. Also, your hand just isn't that good anymore. I think I would check. What do you like?
Yeah, it's certainly a tough spot. The blocking Jack 10 is a pretty big deal, not so much in terms of trying to rep Jack 10, because I think you're right, Nate, that you're going to have trouble getting people to fold two pair or better. But I think that, you know, the chance of the 8 having improved someone to the point where they're now crushing you is not that high. 5-6 is probably in people's ranges. Certainly hands like 9-8, 8-7, pocket eights, those are all plausible for people. You have a fair amount of equity against hands like 9-8 and 8-7. You can peel off some two pairs that counterfeit them. You can peel off a straight jack. You know, you're not dead in the water to those hands. But yeah, I don't know that you really benefit all that much from betting here. I don't think you have great value targets anymore. Some hands that you're ahead of, like ace nine or queen nine, might actually consider folding here. I mean, I don't know how much actual live opponents do that. I think they probably should if you bet again here. I don't think like calling with ace nine is all that appealing. Should you bet again here? But yeah, I think with two opponents being in the pot, the chances of jacks being the best hand aren't that good, and I don't think you benefit that much from fold equity anymore. So when we talked about, you know, the reasons for betting the flop, part of the argument for betting the flop was not just that you're going to be called by hands that you're beating, but also that you're going to generate some folds from hands that have equity against you. And I think to some degree you've done that already. I mean, obviously no one folded, but like, I think to the degree that you were going to get a fold from a hand like ace high or king high or queen high, you know, you would have gotten it by now. So I think it's like unlikely that someone is in here just holding a random ace or king or queen that, you know, where you're concerned about getting fold equity against that. I think there's not really draws anymore that are going to be folding, and you're not pushing that much of an equity advantage. If you bet here and get called by like 8-6, I mean, you're ahead of it, but you're not crushing it compared to how bad of shape you're in against some of the hands that are beating you. So yeah, I think checking at this point makes sense. And I guess I'm not really that worried about it. I think if you get raised, you can pretty comfortably fold, but you are folding some equity when that happens. So Brendan says, I decided to check on this turn because it's quite a scary card for much of the two players' ranges. Many combinations just made two pair and some straights were completed. I decided to check for pot control, assuming that if I'm bet and raised by cutoff, I certainly have to fold. On the other hand, my hand is now somewhat disguised. I certainly would give up with much of my flop c-bet bluffing range after getting two calls. I would bet flop check turn with king-queen, ace-king, and other complete air combos. I think jacks is near the top of my range. I think that cutoff can be betting a number of hands that I beat in position. I guess we didn't. let me go back and give you the turn action, and I'll finish Brendan's comments. So the board again is 9-7-4-8. Brendan holding pocket jacks. Big blind checks. Brendan checks. Cutoff seems like he's about to check, then grabs a stack of reds, counts $85, and pushes it forward. Big blind folds. Brendan calls. So back to Brendan's comments. I think that cutoff can be betting a number of hands that I beat in position for value slash protection. Pocket 10s, 9x, although I certainly lose to a number of value hands. Sets, straights, two pair. I think that if he floated flop, he should certainly be betting this 8 since it's quite a scary card. Beating quite a bit of value, getting 3-1, and having a gut shot to almost the nuts, I think calling is defensible here. And yeah, I think Nate and I were in agreement that when you check, you're generally going to be planning on calling. The one thing I'll say in terms of like floats, I think it's good to be specific with this. You know, a float is not a hand. A hand is two cards. And if you think about what two cards are you know, would he have in a scenario where he's calling and then bluffing the turn. I wouldn't really expect it to be like king queen offsuit. I would expect it to be maybe queen jack, which unfortunately you're blocking. I mean, that strikes me as where he has like a backdoor. Maybe if it's like queen jack suited with also a backdoor flush draw, you know, that's the kind of hand that might be flooding, but you're blocking that. Other, you know, so-called floats is often going to be hands that had some sort of like gut shot or something on the flop, and that now that it has improved them in some way. So if it's, you know, 8-6 or 8-5 suited, if he's calling with that preflop, or you're blocking jack 8, I guess, hands like those, you know, is he betting those if he has 8-6 or 10-8? Hard to say. I mean, I kind of don't think that he should be, but as we were saying in the previous hand discussion, I think sometimes people do just bet when their hand has equity without really thinking about what is the purpose of that bet. You know, we've certainly discussed that concept many times on the show. So, you know, I think it's possible that he's betting hands like those. I just think sort of referring to floats generically is a little sloppy.
Yep, I think that's right. I also think that this physical behavior means strength a fair amount. I wouldn't hate a trusting fold here, but sure. Call's fine.
Yeah. And it is only a half pot bet. I mean, he's getting, like you said, it's getting 3-1.
I would too. I'm just saying, yeah. If you know your opponent, that behavior, like, oh, shucks, oh, man, I'll check up. You know what? I'll do you guys a favor. I'll just throw $85 out there. I'm just saying that's,
yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, good. But default, certainly call.
And the big blind folded. So we go to the river, heads up now. $325 in the pot. It's a 3 of diamonds. Brendan says, I check. Cutoff thinks a moment before counting out $175 and pushing it forwards. I go into the tank for about 45 seconds and then say, sorry guys, I'll make my decision soon. The dealer says, take your time. Shortly after, I throw in a calling chip.
Nope.
go ahead, what were you going to say?
Wrong answer. Thanks for writing. This is a fold. Do you beat a value bet? No. Is he bluffing? Maybe, but probably not. What should you do? Fold. Is it more complicated than that, Andrew?
Well, we are getting 3-1. We do block the nuts. I wouldn't be so quick to rule out the bluffs. I guess the main hand that I'm considering, like I mentioned on the turn, is, you know, what's happening with like the 8-6, the 10-8, the 7-6, all these kind of like weak pair plus scutter kinds of hands. I mean, I agree that we don't beat a value bet, and I don't generally like calling with pure bluff catchers. This isn't really a pure bluff catcher, though. I mean, blocking jack 10 is a pretty big deal here, and I do think that some of the same, like the kind of person who doesn't bluff very much in this situation also doesn't thin value bet in this situation. So I do think, you know, hands like 8-7 or sort of like a weak two pair, many, like the player who doesn't bluff is also not betting bottom two or, you know, middle two or whatever for value here. So I think that...
Wait. I'm going to go next level on you here.
Okay.
The player who doesn't value bet two pair here doesn't turn a hand into a bluff, and he's almost certainly got some sort of hand.
I think,
or does he?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's one of those. I mean, I agree. I don't generally expect people to be bluffing with pairs in their hands, but I think that this is the kind of situation where it happens, because he bet the turn without really having much of a plan. Like, you know, I think he realizes on the turn that like 7-6 isn't good against two people, or like 8-6 isn't that good against two people. And I mean, you were just talking about having someone bluff the second nuts previous.
Sure.
You know, I think sometimes you get people who are just kind of like firing at the pot because they don't really know what else to do.
That's fair.
That seems plausible enough to me. Like getting 3-1 and very heavily blocking the hands that he's definitely value betting. I guess I would allow for enough of a possibility of his like spazzing. I mean, we do know results on this hand, so it's possible I'm being a little results oriented, but.
Yeah. I mean, I guess what I'll say is I would rely on a live read here. Probably. Mm-hmm. I think that like in theory, you shouldn't be folding an overpair getting 3-1. But I also think that a lot of people are going to be way under bluffing here. And I think the opponent, as described, I'm willing to make a tight fold here. I'll have other hands to call with. It's going to be a mistake sometimes. And I I think this is a pretty good spot to fold.
So would you just fold the spot 100%? I mean, is there any hand that you check call the turn that you would check call the river? I'm not saying that's necessarily bad. I mean, there are certainly spots where I think it's fine, you know, in live poker to have a 100% river folding range, but
against this guy, yeah, it's hard to think of a hand that I would just check call the turn with. You know, if somehow I backed into two pair on the river or something, like a good two pair, then you start to beat some value bets. No, I would probably be vastly overfolding.
Yeah, because I could see playing like aces this way also, and I would rather fold aces on the river than jacks.
It's interesting because you block jack 10.
Yeah, I don't think he's betting like queens.
Yeah, you'll see it.
I don't know. I don't even expect to see like 8-7 here.
Yeah. Fair. No, you can see a bluff, but you know, again, the pot was three-handed on the flop. I mean, in practice, I'm going to be using the physical read a lot here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like a fold. Given what we know, I like a fold. I like a trusting fold. Maybe I get owned, but I'm comfortable with that. I think it's close, but I like the fold. But I guess I'm wrong, given the results.
Brendan did end up winning. He says, results. Villain is clearly upset when I throw the chip in, and I ask, do you have it? He responds, do I have it? Of course I don't have it. I table my jacks, and Villain starts to explode at the dealer while he's pushing the pot, screaming, how could you tell him to take his time? You're supposed to be silent. You influence play. His hand was almost in the muck. My hand was not almost in the muck. The dealer, seems experienced, says, I just wanted to ensure we didn't rush the player. Villain responds, how do you know he was feeling rushed? Dealers push to the next table. Villain continues on his rant for about 15 minutes, calling over the floor, complaining to everyone at the table, etc. The main gist is that he thinks the dealer was out of line for telling me to take my time. I had not yet made any motion indicating that I was ready to fold. Is the dealer in the wrong here?
Depends on the place. The traditional answer is that the dealer should just shut up and deal the cards. Like the old school answer to like what is the correct thing for a dealer to say in situation X is nothing most of the time. But like honestly, that was a long time ago. And like take your time. Like you hear that all the time. Mm. And Villain is obviously just upset that he lost the pot and or they're not going to pay for the wall. And it's just not a big deal. It's just not a big deal. You hear things like that all the time. It's the dealer is, depending on sort of culture and history and whatever, either not in the wrong or moderately in the wrong, and it's just not a big deal.
Yeah, I'm inclined to borrow a bit from debate terminology and say no impact, which is to say your argument may be true, or not your argument, but you know, this guy's argument that the dealer shouldn't have said anything may be true, but it's of no consequence. Like, it doesn't mean that he doesn't, like, there's just nothing should happen as a result of that. Like maybe the next time he has this dealer, he doesn't tip him a dollar or something, but it's just like, it's not the kind of thing that the floor is going to like overturn the hand based on the fact that the dealer made a like offhand comment. It's not the sort of thing the dealer needs to be like officially scolded for by the floor or like have his paycheck. Like, I don't, there's no consequence to it.
I'm not sure about that. Depending on a lot of things, like let's say I'm the floor supervisor, hypothetically, and this guy comes and rants to me about how this like no good dealer cost him a pot, I would say like probably no, he didn't. Like I would stick up for my dealer to the person, right. But like, you know, I would probably say like, hey, yeah, Fred,
better
you
not
know,
to do that.
Yeah, better just to not say anything.
Yeah, okay. I guess so. No consequence in terms of it. It's not going to affect, like, there's no scenario where this should lead to like the villain somehow getting the pot back or something, which maybe is not what he was asking for anyway. But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, fundamentally, he's just sort of angry about losing and looking to blame it on someone other than himself, is my read.
Yep.
Well, thank you very much for writing, Brendan. Thank you to everyone who wrote in, and thank you to Nate for making time to do this. Always fun to get to do one of these episodes where we just get to talk to each other for a little bit.
Yeah, good times. And thank you. And thanks for listening. Hey, here's something we haven't said for like 2 years. If you rate and review us on iTunes, it helps people find the show. Like literally, if you go to our iTunes page and look at the reviews, it's almost all from 2012 and way, way, way back when. And if you want to support the show in a way that costs you $0, you can let people on iTunes know about us, rate and review.
You've outed yourself, Nate, for not listening to some of my solo intros. I have been encouraging people to rate and review on iTunes recently.
I just forgot. By me, I mean I haven't said this in years. So. And frankly, it hasn't been working last I checked.
Yeah, that may be the case, yes.
Maybe they'll listen to me.
So. Oh, actually, last question for you, Nate, or maybe it's more an eagerness on my part, but with the New Year podcasts, rating, reviewing on iTunes, I've been saying a lot of stuff lately of... I guess maybe more towards the end of last year, but sort of like best podcast of the year, like best new podcast or that sort of thing. Is there anything you're listening to that you want to recommend to people?
Brian Koffelman's back. He's now doing The Moment, not under the Slate aegis. I ought to be bipartisan with my snark and, a Brian Koffelman show. And yeah, Brian Koppelman is one of my favorite people doing things out there. Slate is not one of my favorite outlets out there. So Brian Koppelman show, it's back. I would recommend that you listen to that. Conversations with Tyler, excellent, excellent podcast. I think he's quietly sort of pushing pushing the boundaries of what's possible and conventional with podcasts. And these are really a terrific series. So Conversations with Tyler, really like that.
I haven't heard of that. What kind of conversations does Tyler have?
Tyler Cowen, the economist.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He does conversations. And the idea is that like it's intended as like a very advanced discussion of something. So like if not all the listeners understand all the terminology in the questions, it's they don't care. The idea is to have a sort of world-class level conversation about something and just let you listen in. And at least that's the theory behind it. So there's a lot of really sort of, there's a lot of introductory material, but also a lot of very advanced discussions of things that you don't often get. So I highly recommend it. It's really good. And also very inspiring for people who want to read a lot, for people who want to be intellectually active. It's a great source of inspiration, I find. If you like baseball, the Effectively Wild podcast now has a new co-host, new like in the last year. I think Jeff Sullivan does a really good job. I think Effectively Wild now is, better than it's ever been. So I like that. And Hanselman, if you like tech, Scott Hanselman's podcast is just great. He's just crushing it. He just does a really good half-hour interview twice a week or however often. And he's got a lot of great people on the show. Highly recommended. And Angela Bassa went on Scott Hanselman's show. And I think that's awesome because we started Angela on her podcasting.
That's always cool when you're listening to something and you have a guest in common with them.
Yeah. But in terms of new stuff, I'm not sure.
Which, by the way, Brian Koppelman is our guest in common with Mark Maron.
Yes. So listen to Brian's show. Listen to any of that other stuff if you want to listen to it. What about you? You got a new podcast you like?
The main one I wanted to plug, and this is not really even the podcast as a whole, because the only thing I've listened to that they've done has been this one series, but the 538 Politics podcast. So this is Nate Silver's project. Anyway, he's not involved. He's not on the podcast or not on this particular project that they're doing, but they're doing, or at least I'm not sure if they finished it and I just haven't listened to the end of it yet, or if the last episode hasn't come out yet, but they did a series on gerrymandering, which I found really interesting. It's an issue that I've kind of been like concerned about, or like voting rights in general, I think is like an issue that I've been trying to learn more about, that I think is a pretty significant deal right now. And gerrymandering is the kind of thing, I guess, for those who maybe aren't in the United States, this has to do with like how we draw district lines in the United States, like for determining how representatives are chosen. Drawing a particular district, people have incentives, and often the people being elected are the ones doing the drawing or involved in the drawing of these district lines. So there's like some conflicts of interest going on, but you know, people are have various interests in drawing districts in ways that might favor them or whatever. That's the concern anyway, is that, you know, this is being done in some sort of like partisan way. And it's the, so it's the kind of thing that like sounds really bad and like, I mean, is problematic, but I think it's a much more complicated issue than it seems on the surface. And I think the podcast does a really nice job of, you know, they go to look in depth at a couple of different conflicts related to redistricting or gerrymandering, and looking at using those to get at broader topics related to redistricting, because I think it turned out to be a little more complicated than it seems. To this, like, I think there's like kind of broad disagreement that like redistricting for like political purposes or to advantage oneself is not good, but it's not really like, I don't know that there's as much agreement about what it should look like. I think there's some broad agreement about what it shouldn't be, but not a lot of agreement about what it should be, and not even a lot of agreement about how to achieve some of the things that maybe there is broad agreement about what it should be. So I think that podcast does a nice job of explaining the complexities of that topic. And, you know, there is some game theory involved there as well, and some big data stuff going on. So it overlaps a little bit with some topics that might be of interest to people listening to this show.
Very good. Very good. So go listen to that stuff. Thank you for listening to us, and have a great week, everyone.
Yeah, take care.
Some kind of pill, or the devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law.
Hi, Sean. I just want to say I hope you're having a great day.
Sorry about that.
That's cool.